The narrative about Detroit.
It's such a novelistic arc in a way. You've got, you know, one of the great American cities of the 20th century rising from the plains, you know, and becoming the fourth largest city in the U.S., giving us not only the auto industry, but just really, you know, revolutionizing American industry and manufacturing and, you know, in some ways creating, playing a big part in creating the middle class with these great working class jobs, and then falling from such great heights.
But that's not the only story one can tell about Detroit. The other is about the resilience of its residents in the face of decline. Mark Benelli is our guest this hour. His book, Detroit City is the Place to Be, The Afterlife of an American Metropolis. This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. On December 3rd, Judge Stephen Rhodes ruled the city of Detroit eligible for bankruptcy. The ruling put city workers' pensions at risk, setting a precedent that other financially precarious cities are eyeing. Once, Detroit was known as the birthplace of the middle class, a place of good jobs offering opportunity to poor African Americans migrating from the South, impoverished European immigrants seeking a better life, and migrants from hard-bitten rural areas. But Detroit has long been falling on hard times, and its impending bankruptcy is the final nail in the coffin. Or is it? Detroit's trajectory from pioneer boomtown to motor city to post-industrial ruin is part of American myth, and much of it is true. But my guest, journalist Mark Benelli, is interested in a more nuanced narrative. Not a narrative of despair, but one of resilience in the face of adversity, and even possibly renaissance. A native of Detroit who left to work as a journalist, Benelli went back in 2009 to find out what was happening in the wake of the Great Recession. He found that the story was not all gloom and doom, that there were signs of vitality as residents tried to remake their lives in a kind of post-apocalyptic landscape. Some were longtime residents finding new ways to live. Some community activists who saw in the diminished city the chance to create a more democratic, sustainable Detroit. Others were artists and new tech entrepreneurs moving into now cheap lofts where they could work. Benelli saw some real reasons for hope among the ruins. But now, with the bankruptcy, the screws are being tightened even more. Benelli writes about that side also in his book, a city with a real unemployment rate of 50%, firefighters working for 10 bucks an hour who don't have the resources to fight the fires raging around them, auto workers fighting to keep a living wage, and retirees who are being robbed of their hard-earned pensions. Which Detroit will emerge? A downsized but more sustainable city? Or a shattered metropolis knocked to the dirt and down for the count? Time will tell. But after reading Benelli's book, Detroit is the Place to Be, we get the sense that Detroiters won't go down without a fight. Mark Benelli is also the author of the novel Sacco and Vanzetti Must Die and a contributing editor at Rolling Stone and Men's Journal. I spoke with him in November when the decision to let Detroit go bankrupt was in the air, but not yet known. Well, Mark Benelli, welcome to Writer's Voice. Your book, Detroit City is the Place to Be, is just a really fascinating read. I think we've seen most of the reporting on Detroit is of Detroit in decline, although there was this amazing film called Detropia, which I saw a couple of years ago or last year, which talked about some of the ways in which it's coming back. But before we talk about the current situation and what you found when you went to Detroit, tell us a little bit about your own background. You grew up there.
I did. I grew up in a suburb called St. Clair Shores, which if any of your listeners are familiar with the work of Eminem, they might know about 8 Mile Road, which is the historic dividing line between the city and the suburbs. So I grew up, you know, it was about 8.5 Mile Road, I guess, is right around where I grew up. St. Clair Shores is suburb on the east side, very working class, a lot of auto workers in that area. It's the home of the Reagan Democrats, which is a term Stan Greenberg, the pollster, came up for Democrats. Working class voters who traditionally voted Democratic, who sort of switched their allegiances to Ronald Reagan in the 80s. My parents were both Italian immigrants, and they came from a valley in northern Italy in the Trentino region. My father's, he's retired now, but he was a knife sharpener. So I grew up in the suburb, but spending a lot of time in the city proper, where my dad's shop was, working for him, making deliveries as I got older. And I think my experience was fairly typical for suburbanites of my age and younger. I was born in 1970, and so Detroit was a place where you were discouraged from going, generally, unless, you know, there was a reason to go downtown for a ball game or to take visiting relatives to Greek Town or one of the tourist attractions. Beyond that, you were encouraged to stay away. At the same time, though, I was spending a lot of time there, you know, working for my father. So the city always really kind of held a peculiar attraction to me. I found it was very close, but also very mysterious, and I always thought I would write about it in some way.
And then you went back. When did you go back? And you went back to a place not too far from where your father's father's shop had been. Is that right?
Yes, I went back in 2009. I initially went back. By that point, I had written a novel, was working on a second novel, but it kind of stalled out. And I was also a features writer at Rolling Stone by that point. And I went back in January of 2009 to attend the Detroit Auto Show, which you probably remember that was a very dire period. The world economy really was in free fall, and in Detroit specifically, there were the big three auto companies were on the verge of bankruptcy. They'd just gone hat in hand to Congress to ask for bailouts. Of course, they'd made the PR blunder of flying to Washington in private jets. Then they had to drive back in hybrid vehicles to atone for that. So I went back that January to the auto show, the big, which was the sort of, you know, traditionally been the big party of the year for the big three automakers. And I thought it would be an interesting time to attend the show and an interesting way to talk about the crisis in the auto industry. In an article for Rolling Stone. When I got back, I really just seemed like such an interesting time, and it seemed like so many people were looking at Detroit as a sort of all-purpose metaphor for everything that was going wrong. So I decided to move back. And yes, as you said, I ended up in a neighborhood close to downtown called Eastern Market. It's an area where there's a big farmers market every weekend, and they're still working slaughterhouses and produce wholesalers, but there are also lofts where people live. And it's not that close to where my father's shop was, but I on the very block where I moved, there was an old butcher supply shop where I used to make deliveries as a kid. So that was a strange flashback when I pulled into the back alley to check out my new apartment for the first time, which I just found randomly on Craigslist. I had this sudden rush of deja vu, and I remembered, you know, driving back there as a teenager, going into the service entrance of this butcher supply shop.
Yeah, and you found a city in transition in several directions. In fact, you talk about the narrative about Detroit, and here I'm going to quote from your book, Detroit City is the Place to Be. The story of the city, its meteoric rise and stunning fall, possesses the sort of narrative arc to which people seem hardwired to respond, unquote. But you were interested in a different story than that narrative.
Well, I mean, that narrative initially did attract me, and for years I always thought I would write a novel about the city, actually. It's such a novelistic arc in a way. You've got, you know, one of the great American cities of the 20th century, rising from the plains, you know, and becoming the fourth largest city in the U.S., giving us not only the auto industry, but just really, you know, revolutionizing American industry and manufacturing, and you know, in some ways creating, playing a big part in creating the middle class with these great working class jobs, and then falling from such great heights, and then who knows what happens next. And it is such a great story for me, though. Yeah, I saw when I came back that January, I saw so many reporters coming from all over the country, all over the world, to report on Detroit, to use Detroit's, you know, the ruins of the old factories as a sort of visual backdrop for these very complicated stories about what was going on with the recession. And I saw the same story being told over and over and over and over. It was really so one note and so tedious to see. And I started to think about how I could hopefully, as a native, bring more nuance and more sensitivity to the story, and not just interview the same five people, and not just tell the stories of gloom and destruction. Although I certainly don't shy away from any of that in the book, and I have not written a book that I consider Pollyanna-ish in any way, but there's so much more to the city. And just as a writer, it really appealed to, you know, what really appealed to me as a fan of writers like people like Ian Fraser or Joseph Mitchell from The New Yorker. I love the idea of a city like Detroit with so many weird and forgotten corners, and I love the idea of finding great characters just as subjects, and bringing out elements of the story like humor, which, when you're telling a story, when you're writing about Detroit in a, you know, in a newspaper story or a short magazine piece, that kind of stuff is often just left out for, you know, and the focus is put on the starkest details. I thought with the book I could really, you know, explore the whole tapestry of the city.
And you do that wonderfully, Mark Benelli, in the book, Detroit City is the Place to Be, the Afterlife of an American Metropolis. I want to go on to that narrative that you found, but also with a little bit of background. I was surprised. I remember the Detroit riots. I guess that dates me. I was pretty young, but I do remember them. And I think, like a lot of people, I thought that Detroit started to go down after the 1967 riots. But you put a context to them. You say that the process began before that. And I think that would be pretty interesting for our listeners to hear.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's a common misconception. And certainly things, the 67 riots accelerated the white flight and the overall decline of the city in certain ways, but really the seeds of Detroit's current state, you could trace them all the way back to the 50s, which was when the population started leaving the city, and along with lots of the businesses, and you know, there was just a steady flow of capital out of the city for a variety of reasons, many of them hinging ultimately on race. You had this suburban sprawl growing up, really, you know, ironically, the sprawl that was really fostered and promoted by the auto industry, right? Everybody needed to have a car, and you could drive out to the green fields of these new suburbs, and so this was being promoted all over the country. In Detroit, it was happening very intensely, and not only citizens of the city, but factories and other businesses were being lured out to these new suburbs as well, with promises of low taxes, sometimes no taxes. You know, these were basically just empty green fields where there was no existing infrastructure, so they could very cheap, they could offer cheap land and lure people out there. Meanwhile, of course, the Detroit metro area would ultimately become one of the most segregated in the country. Black residents were basically redlined out of most of the suburbs, And so so you had this very toxic divide that started, as I said, in the 50s and just it only accelerated after 67. And, you know, immediately post riots, I've talked to African-American Detroit residents who can remember relatives sort of cheering as white residents packed up and left and saying, you know, good riddance. There had been such terrible relations for so long, and Black Detroiters had been kept out of a lot of neighborhoods within Detroit for years and years. And so the chance that sort of taking a reins in the city was, I think, exciting for a lot of Black Detroiters. But there were so many other forces aligned against that working out, including the hostile suburbs and just a general, general sort of flow of capital out of the city and a complete disinvestment, which, you know, that's a tide that's hard to swim against.
You know, you're mentioning the racial divide and the suburbs. We had recently had a tragedy that happened in Dearborn,
it was Dearborn Heights, I think.
Dearborn Heights, that's right.
Which is neighboring Dearborn.
Yeah, with Renisha McBride. I wonder if you could, you know, this was a 19-year-old African-American girl who had an accident and went up to a house to request some help and got shot in the face. And the assailant basically is at large, has not been arrested. I wonder if you could put that into the context of the racial divide. Is this part of the ancient history that you're talking about?
Yeah, it's such a sad story. And I mean, Dearborn is interesting. Dearborn and I guess Dearborn Heights by extension, which is a neighboring suburb, that's where Henry Ford grew up. So it was farmland, you know, over a hundred years ago when he was growing up. He really hated living on a farm, and that sort of drove him to move into the city of Detroit. Eventually, though, when Ford really started taking off, when the Ford Motor Company really started taking off, he moved the suburbs, the headquarters back out to Dearborn, and a whole suburb grew up around it. For years, interestingly, Dearborn was the mayor was a staunch segregationist, and Black residents, I mean, he was very openly racist, and Black residents were basically kept out. Black workers at the Ford Rouge plant, which was way out in that sort of western edge of the suburban area of Detroit, mostly lived in another suburb called Inkster, which was the Black suburb. That, of course, those legal barriers have since fallen away, and Dearborn, interestingly, has become has a lot very large Arabic population, lots of Syrians, Iraqis, Lebanese people. So the makeup of Dearborn has radically changed from those days. But yeah, this event, you know, I've been sort of strangely more optimistic on this front, on the idea of Metro Detroit's segregation. This last census, the 2010 census, you finally saw some of these old walls breaking down a little bit. The suburbs, in general, are far, far more diverse than they ever have been. You're seeing lots of Black residents leaving Detroit. You know, white flight ended a long time ago, but now you're seeing middle-class Black flight as the population of the city proper continues to decline largely because of crime and because the school system is so bad. So Black residents are just crossing 8 Mile Road and moving to the suburbs, so you're seeing the suburbs become much more diverse. And conversely, you're seeing the city, the white population of the city, is starting to take up largely because of younger people, artists, and people like that moving into certain neighborhoods. And so the white population of the city rose for the first time, I believe, in about 40 years. So, of course, a few days ago, Detroit elected its first white mayor in about 40 years. So I think all those events really give me hope that there could be more regionalism, more cooperation between city and suburbs, But then you see an event like this tragic shooting, and it's hard to retain your optimism.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Mark Benelli about his book, Detroit City is the Place to Be, The Afterlife of an American Metropolis. Now, you mentioned depopulation. I think that the population has been something like halved from its peak. There are vast areas of Detroit that are called the urban prairie because there's lots of open spaces as houses have been, you know, demolished. There's a policy called shrinking the city. I wonder if you could talk about that and what your take on it is.
Sure. Well, it was there were lots of sort of euphemistic terms for this plan. Right-sizing was one that got kicked around a lot. Basically, the idea is Detroit is about 140 square miles. The city itself, this isn't including any of the suburbs. So this is a very sprawling, spread-out city. I'd compare it. People have been to L.A. It's very similar to. It's a driving city. Lots of individual homes with garages and driveways. At its population peak, Detroit's population was something like 2 million. Now it's right around 700,000. So you've got all this land, you know, too much land for this population, and a city that's broke. You know, as your listeners know, Detroit filed for bankruptcy earlier this summer. So they really don't have the resources to service such a huge amount of space. The idea behind a plan that was originally called the Detroit Works Project, is now called Detroit Future City, was to essentially incentivize people to move from the urban prairies, these extremely depopulated neighborhoods. They were once dense residential neighborhoods, but now you go to some of these areas and there'll be one or two houses left on a block. There'll be fields around you, you know, with the grass going up to your waist in the summer, and you could be in somewhere in rural Alabama, but you're 5 minutes from downtown Detroit. It's really surreal being in some of these neighborhoods. So the idea is to coax these residents out of these homes, get everybody in, packed into tighter, you know, more easily serviceable, dense urban cores, and then turn this extra land into an asset. People are talking about making this extra space, which, you know, by some estimates, is about 40 square miles of vacant land, which you could fit, you know, Paris in that space, transforming that space into parks, into urban farms and gardens, into what people are calling blue space, which is sort of like a wetland. There are all sorts of very interesting and ambitious things you can do. The problem, of course, is there's no money to do any of these things. Even the initial study, which, as I said, came to be called Detroit Future City, that took about 3 years. They brought in an urban planner from Harvard and had a whole team of people working on this and figuring out the best way to sort of reimagine Detroit. That was all funded by a private foundation. And since then, of course, the city's gone into bankruptcy. So there's, you look at these renderings of what Detroit could become in 20 years, and it's very exciting, but it's hard to see how we get there, at least considering the current economic situation in the city.
This policy, there's some good ideas there, but you also say that there's a price to pay on some of the local residents. What are some of the objections that local residents made to the idea of shrinking the city?
Well, Detroiters have long memories, and they're rightfully wary, I think, of top-down urban renewal projects. If you go back again to the 50s, in the name of urban renewal, a freeway was built right through the heart of the main part of the historic African-American neighborhood. It was called Black Bottom. It was this sort of thriving business district, nightclub district. That was all raised, you know, to build an extension of the I-75 freeway. And there were promises made, you know, about affordable housing and things like that that never really came to pass. So people are wary about that, and it's tricky. You know, it's not easy to assemble large enough parcels of land, even if you had the money to maintain, to sort of landscape and maintain, let's say, a beautiful new park with all this extra land. It's not easy to assemble all of these vacant plots into one single landmass. There are houses dotted all over. These neighborhoods are dotted all over the city. It's not like there's one concentrated area of vacant land. And there's no eminent domain in Michigan, so you can't force people to move. There's been some talk of maybe the city government would just tell residents, you know, we won't be servicing your neighborhood anymore if you decide to continue to live in that neighborhood. I'm not sure if that would actually be legal if somebody's paying taxes. I think they have to still receive basic city services. And then there's the problem of, which has also been a really, you know, sticky problem for Detroit, the problem of absentee landlords and land speculators. When once the neighborhoods that will be sort of more developed are announced, you'll definitely have people who've been sitting on old vacant properties for years, or people who could rush in and snatch up this cheap land. They would hold a lot of power. And so none of this will be a cheap or easy fix. There are lots of potential roadblocks along the way.
And yet there are people who are kind of doing a do-it-yourself greening of the city, artists, as you mentioned before, moving in, people who are from Detroit, who are creating a whole network of urban gardens. You have an amazing figure. You say that there are 5,000 acres of vacant land that just belongs to the city alone that could, if farmed, supply 75% of fresh vegetables and 40% of non-tropical fruits for all Detroit residents. I mean, this is an astonishing figure, an astonishing idea. Talk about the urban farming movement, and we'll talk about the artists too, but talk first about the urban farming movement there.
Sure, yeah, that's one of the sort of hopeful signs in Detroit, and one that got a lot of attention, I think journalists, especially like me, you know, especially, there's something so metaphorically wonderful about you know, hope literally growing from the post-industrial soil, right? So yeah, but it's something that that is really happening on a neighborhood level. People are living next door to these vacant lots where maybe a house burned down years ago and nothing ever replaced it. And so they would just a lot of this was just happening, you know, without any support from the government. I mean, the Detroit government is famously dysfunctional, so there wasn't. It's not that easy to get legal permission to farm on a vacant lot. I mean, it's not easy for the Detroit government to even figure out who owns some of these lots. The record keeping is so bad. So people just started doing it themselves. They planted little gardens, sometimes larger farms. One of the places where I was living in Detroit, it was a kind of surreal experience. I had moved back to Detroit from New York City, where I live in Little Italy, and it's, you know, it's a very noisy, typically New York area, and I'm very used to it, and it never bothers me. And when people come to visit, they really pick up on how noisy it is, and I don't even notice it anymore. I moved back to Detroit, and I find myself being woken up regularly by this rooster that was crowing from this farm right behind where I was living. So, you see these sorts of farms and gardens all over the city. And you also started to see people talking about larger scale operations, which is an interesting idea. Some Detroiters were wary of that. Some of the smaller grassroots people working more on the grassroots level were nervous about the idea of these bigger farms coming in. It was called sort of a plantation, regression to like a plantation model. One guy in particular, a hedge fund guy named John Hance, wanted to wanted to amass a lot of land and build a large-scale farm where he would grow things like Christmas trees and fruit trees and a whole range of things. That plan was sort of slowed down, but it's all very interesting. I mean, it wouldn't single-handedly solve the problems of Detroit in any way, but it is a very, I think, creative way to solve the problem of all this vacant land.
Mark Benelli, talking about his book, Detroit City is the Place to Be, The Afterlife of an American Metropolis. We'll talk more after the break. Don't go away. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Mark Benelli about his book, Detroit City is the Place to Be. When we left off, Benelli had just told us about a controversial urban agriculture project started by a hedge fund manager. That project failed, but local residents have undertaken urban farming and other sustainability initiatives, some of which are thriving.
And the idea of a hedge fund guy coming in and doing some kind of possibly industrial farm in the center of Detroit is contrasted by the local efforts of folks like nonagenarian Grace Lee Boggs with her Boggs Center for Social Progress, who's mounted a whole idea about, you know, Detroit becoming a self-sustainable city. You call it left-wing utopianism. You seem to mistrust these efforts.
Well, I guess I'm very sympathetic to Grace Boggs and to a lot of those neighborhood level activists. I think that's one of Detroit's great assets, the fact that people have been living for years in what's essentially a failed state and just have been forced to sort of take their destiny into their own hands. I think you've got lots of people and lots of even below a neighborhood level, like on a block level, you'll drive through certain areas of Detroit that seem ravaged, but there'll be a single block that's really thriving and flourishing, and you see those kind of things, and that really does give one hope. I guess, you know, I think I gently tease and express some skepticism about a certain attitude of, I call it the dystopian happy ending in the book. I think there's a certain way of looking at Detroit of almost celebrating the exodus of these auto companies who, you know, were creating these horrible polluting vehicles. And there's a way of cheering that sort of post-industrial decline and saying, you know, essentially good riddance. We don't need these auto factories anymore. We don't want these auto factories anymore. We want to just plant gardens here in the backyard and take control of our own neighborhoods. And it's a legitimate, essentially, anarchist almost embrace of what's gone on in Detroit and the current state of the city. I find it interesting, but in some cases, there is that utopian side to anarchism that also becomes a bit unrealistic.
Mm. And yet the utopianism of today sometimes can become the system of tomorrow, or at least something to be thought of. So left-wing utopianism on the one hand, on the other hand, a kind of disaster capitalism taking over Detroit, which you also outline in the book. You talk about a true employment figure that's close to 50%. As you mentioned before, and we all know, Detroit has declared bankruptcy. It does seem to me that there are winners and losers in this. They talk about everybody taking a haircut, but some people are being scalped.
Oh, definitely. I mean, it was interesting being in Detroit while this new narrative took hold of Detroit's comeback. This happened about, I would say, halfway through my return, and I think it was sort of epitomized in those Super Bowl ads that Chrysler ran with Clint Eastwood and Eminem sort of cheering on. The tagline was imported from Detroit, and it was really cheering on Detroit manufacturing, and the narrative suddenly became the bailout worked, the auto industry is back. Of course, on the ground in Detroit, really what you were seeing was, yes, the bailout worked in a sense, and it was necessary. If the auto companies had just been allowed to go bankrupt and go out of business, that would have caused immense suffering. But to my mind, it was a very similar thing to the bank bailouts. You saw lots of taxpayer money being given to these massive multinational corporations to restore them to profitability, but there wasn't any accountability, and not much of that trickled down to the average worker. So you see some of these auto jobs are coming back, but the people being hired post-bailout are making about half of what you would have made pre-bailout. And, it was more about corporate profit than anything else. And you're seeing the same thing in the way the bankruptcy is playing out. The pensions of retired city workers are protected by the state constitution, but they're being put on the table alongside the money that's owed to Wall Street banks. And a lot of Detroit's debt on the sort of Wall Street side of it comes from the sorts of shady swap deals that collapsed the economy in the first place and really sent the city into a tailspin. So yeah, it's in a lot of ways it's more of the same on that level.
Yeah, and some of those guys are going to get like 100 cents on the dollar. There's a very interesting article in The Guardian yesterday, as we're doing this interview today, that interviewed some firefighters who are going to be losing pensions and other benefits that they, paid for years. And one guy said, it used to be about race in Detroit. I think he was talking about conflict. He said, now it's all about class.
That's a good point. I mean, Detroit was always a very strong, working class city, but it also broke down along racial lines in the ways I talked about earlier. But in one of the chapters in the book, I spend some time with firefighters in a city called Highland Park, which is a city within the city limits of Detroit. It's where Ford's original Model T plant was. Ford, of course, left. Chrysler's headquarters was there for years and years. They also left for a suburb about 30 miles north. So now Highland Park is a very poor city. I call it the Detroit of Detroit in the book. And these firefighters I spent time with were operating out of an old Chrysler warehouse. Their firehouse had been condemned about 5 years earlier. Some of them were sleeping in tents. Others were living in this sort of, I guess it almost felt like a shanty town. I mean, it was the particle board nailed together the way, in a similar way you would if you were a student at a university and wanted to sort of subdivide a dorm room or something. They didn't have enough walkie-talkies, so at fires they had developed a series of hand signals to communicate with each other. The fire trucks would break down. I mean, it was unbelievable. The conditions they were working in a city with lots of fires. I mean, they would get firefighters coming to visit from places like the Bronx and Compton, who coming to take pictures of fires in Highland Park because they don't get fires like that anymore where they're from. And a lot of these guys were making $10 an hour, and it's sort of unbelievable what we're asking of people. And yeah, as you said, when you're talking about retired city workers who were promised these benefits and are now being told they're going to be taken away, the average pension is something like $18,000 a year in Detroit. So it's not these lavish Cadillac pension plans by any means.
You also spent some time with some union folks. Talk about what's happened to the unions in this whole, the resurgence of the auto industry after coming out of bankruptcy. What position are they in now?
They're in a depressingly weak position, I guess. I spent time with a guy named John Zimmick, who was the president of Walter Reuther's old local, Reuther being, of course, the great UAW president who really brought the UAW to its sort of greatest heights. He was described at one point by Mitt Romney's dad when he was governor of Michigan, I believe, as the most dangerous man in America.
And why? Say why he said that.
Because, the unions, he had so much power as a union leader. The battle of the overpass took place on a bridge leading to the Ford Rouge plant, which was, considered this really impregnable, unorganizable plant. And Reuther and some other of his guys were publicly beaten on this bridge by some of Henry Ford's goons. Basically, he had they weren't really even security guards; they were just these goons. And a photographer was there that became known as the Battle of the Overpass, and that was really this flashpoint. So Reuther did more than anyone to really unionize all of the auto company, all of the big three automakers, and it was considered a threat to corporate America. Fast forward to today, and I was spending time with this guy John Zimmick at Reuther's old local, and this was at a time when, a week earlier, the big three were posting record profits, and the headlines in the Wall Street Journal and the Times were basically like, Detroit's back, ! Everything's great. And Zimmick was telling me about how his membership was, a third of what it was, just 4 years ago. And how, despite the headlines, he essentially said, we lost. And since then, I think there's been some good news. I mean, people. The sad thing is, people. These new jobs that are about $13 an hour, $14 an hour, which is what new hires now at the auto companies start at. People have been so beaten down. They're very grateful to get these jobs. People aren't really complaining, but they're not the sort of strong middle class jobs that made Detroit great once upon a time in the days of Reuther. So that's where they're at. And of course, since I interviewed Zimmick, Rick Snyder, the governor of Michigan, signed a right to work law, which essentially, the sorts of laws that were in place in southern states for years that further really guts unions.
Right to work, meaning that people don't have to join the union when they're in a workplace where there is a union.
It's really shocking, that a law like that could go through in a state like Michigan that's so historically so, such a strong union state.
Right, with the Flint sit-down strike in the 1930s. We're talking with Mark Benelli about his book, Detroit City is the Place to Be, The Afterlife of an American Metropolis. So there are some points of light, as you talk about, and talk about some of the work that's being done by young people moving in from other places, artists, small tech people. Is that just something that's happening on the margins, or is that a harbinger of some kind of renewal to come?
It's relatively speaking, it's a small small thing, but it's, I think it's a very exciting and important thing to note. There are young people coming from all over. There are also young Detroiters choosing to stay in Detroit, and that's really, you know, that's the sort of energy you need to create a vibrant city moving forward. So yeah, you've got a handful of neighborhoods that are very stable. Historically, of course, lots of money has been poured into these neighborhoods. I'm talking about the downtown core and also what's called Midtown, which is the university district and the sort of medical center. But I would say I moved back in 2009. Even over those past 4 years, some of those neighborhoods, the transformations are you know, some of these neighborhoods are unrecognizable. There's a housing shortage in some of these neighborhoods. You can't find an apartment. So that's really an amazing development. And I think the fact that that the city and the state are they're really encouraging a diverse economy as opposed to putting all the chips on the auto companies is a really really healthy move. There's really been a strong attempt to lure tech companies and just all sorts of entrepreneurs and people are. People are choosing Detroit for a variety of reasons, but including the fact that you can get, there's a lower barrier to entry. You can get office space or factory space for much cheaper, and there are lots of workers here with those the necessary skills, and so that's all very exciting. The problem, of course, is the neighborhoods, which have, you know, historically been ignored and continue to be really dangerous. Many of them, and underserviced. So fixing that vast, those vast areas of Detroit that have been ignored for so long, that I think will be the big challenge. But that sort of downtown heart is really, it's pretty remarkable how far it's come.
You're describing a tale of two cities. It reminds one of what Bill de Blasio talked about with New York. It seems to be that there's an increasing class consciousness. People are, you know, not willing to go along with the old boosterism quite the same way some folks are. What do you see as ahead in terms of, you know, on the one hand, you've talked about, you know, the resurgence. There was a report the other day about mortgage mogul Dan Gilbert, who's bought up some, you know, a couple of million square feet of property, and yet there's also some unease with the fact that one guy is amassing so much power. It seems like there's this two models. One is, you know, people power versus the power of the 1% to come in and change things. I wonder if you could talk about what you see ahead in terms of those two visions.
Yeah, that's a real tension. And I think that's, you know, what we spoke about earlier with the sort of hedge fund John Hantz model of farming versus the Grace Boggs do-it-yourself, you know, neighborhood-level activists is playing out in lots of different arenas. In the case of the big money players like Dan Gilbert of Quicken Loans and Mike Illich, the owner of Little Caesars Pizza, who also owns the Detroit Tigers baseball team, the Detroit Red Wings hockey team, and lots of other properties in Detroit. You're seeing these guys really, yeah, exercise a sort of outsized influence in the direction of the city, at least when you're talking about this downtown core. Dan Gilbert has well, first of all, you know, I think he should be applauded in certain ways. He moved his headquarters from the suburbs downtown fairly early on and has been, you know, proselytizing about the city for the past couple of years, and I think his moves have influenced other people to invest in the downtown area, and I think that's a great thing. But he owns over 40 buildings downtown now. He's creating his own private police force for the downtown area and security hub. You know, there's a light rail system that's being built, a very small tentative step towards having a more comprehensive public transportation system in a city that has never had much of one. That's all being funded by private investors like Gilbert and Illich. as I said earlier, the whole plan to rework the city, the Detroit Future City Project, was funded by nonprofits and private investors. So I think what's troubling to me is when a city is as broke as Detroit, there's a temptation when somebody comes in with a pile of money and says, "Hey, I'm ready to invest." There's an understandable temptation to just throw the doors wide open and hand over the keys. I just think it's troubling, though, to cede so much power to people with no public accountability whatsoever, to these unelected individuals. And right now, a lot of what's been happening in this downtown midtown area has been great and positive, but it does look like an oligarchy when you've got literally a handful of individuals holding so much property and wealth, while the rest of the city remains one of the poorest in the U.S.
Hmm. Well, Mark Benelli, your book Detroit City is the Place to Be is a wonderful read. I highly recommend it to all our listeners, and I want to thank you so much for this fascinating conversation here.
Thanks so much for having me. It was great talking to you.
Mark Benelli's book is Detroit City is the Place to Be, the Afterlife of an American Metropolis. You can read an excerpt at writersvoice.net.
Born to Detroit, Michigan. Girl, I can't take you. Hey, I'm going to Detroit, Michigan. Girl, you got to stay here behind. Gonna get me a job on the Cadillac assembly line.
Mark Benelli made reference to Wall Street's role in the impoverishment of Detroit. Well, a new study out from the think tank Demos, written by a former Wall Street investment banker, reveals how Detroit was starved, perhaps deliberately, of funds it could have used to avoid bankruptcy. The report's author, Wallace Turbeville, spoke on Democracy Now! On December 4th. Turbeville was asked what brought Detroit to the point of bankruptcy. He says to some degree it was engineered by political interests, and Wall Street played a role as well. Here's a clip from that interview on Democracy Now!
Michigan went the way of the Tea Party. And Michigan has, Detroit is the only large city, but there are other cities around it, which are largely old industrial cities and African-American cities for the most part, and Democratic. So there is this tension between the urban centers, which are have a lot of influence from trade unions, and the Republican rest of the state. So it's from a political standpoint, it serves the interest of Governor Snyder and his party to actually undercut the role of trade unions, because they're the ones that are institutions opposed to his political viewpoint. The bankruptcy judge yesterday said one of the issues that was raised was that basically the bankruptcy was the fix was in for it. In other words, the state did it as part of a plan that would restructure the politics. And the judge said, yes, there was evidence of that, actually, but he said not enough to actually make a ruling. Well, I don't have to adhere to rules of evidence from the court. I'm more of the view that if it quacks like a duck and walks like a duck, it's a duck. And if you watch the series of events, first the emergency manager statute that gave them the right to create a dictator in a city, and they've done that in several cities now. By the way, that was pulled back by referendum. So the people of the state of Michigan voted to eliminate that statute. Then the state legislature came back and reenacted it, basically. So it's not a popular statute. But anyway, the idea is have the power to create the emergency manager, create a situation where Detroit has a very hard time keeping its revenues up during this recessionary period, when it's being starved of cash because of property taxes and income taxes and all the rest, then at the last minute cut revenue sharing, and it's starting to look like the whole idea was to push Detroit over the edge in order to have this bankruptcy to restructure it.
Well, one of the things that your report, the Demos report, the Detroit bankruptcy, of which you're the author, points out, is that the financial crisis in Detroit was exacerbated by complicated Wall Street deals that put its ability to pay its expenses at even greater risk. So could you explain what the role of Wall Street was in making the crisis worse?
Yes. In 2005 and 2006, the city, like many cities and states around the country, felt compelled to issue debt to put money into its pension fund. The idea is you borrow the money, you put it in the pension fund, and let's say you can hold it for 30 years and invest it in the stock market, the interest on the debt that you take out is less than the earnings you're going to get on shares of stock. Whether that's wise or not, I won't comment, but it's been done. It was done many, many places. So they issued $1.6 billion of debt. For half of that, they did it in combination with a derivative. Derivative, you might recall, was the large reason for the financial crisis in 2008. AIG, for instance, comes to mind. If everybody remembers that, $180 billion in losses that drove the largest insurance company in the world out of business, or at least into receivership and into bailout. So what happened was they talked the city of Detroit into doing this derivative, and the way it worked is for half, or $800 million of this financing, it's as if you took out a mortgage, borrowed money, and you paid your principal to one bank and the interest to the other bank. On this interest part of the deal, they had a term in it that if Detroit was nicked just one credit rating down, the bank could ask for all of the interest for 25 years that was to become due. They could ask for it now. Now, the city of Detroit had been, I worked in the city of Detroit as a banker at Goldman in 1990 to keep them from getting downgraded, and we successfully managed that, to do financing to do that. City of Detroit has been on the edge of investment grade, non-investment grade for decades. So to do that transaction in 2005 and 2006 and include a term which says all of your interest for 20 years is due now if you get downgraded was just imprudent beyond imagination. I've never seen anything like it. And indeed, of course, that's what happened. And so one of the major issues under discussion right now is that the banks have come and said, I want my interest now. And the question is whether that's going to be adjusted by the bankruptcy court, whether it's negotiated some other way. Right now, the emergency manager has shown no inclination to negotiate that as strongly as I think it should be, frankly.
That was former VP at Goldman Sachs and Demos fellow Wallace Turbeville talking on Democracy Now! On December 4th. Turbeville is the author of a report about the Detroit bankruptcy. Find a link on writersvoice.net. You'll also find a link to his full interview on Democracy Now! That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.